This is Free Speech Radio News for Friday the 13th of May, 2011. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood. Coming up on the newscast: in Syria, tanks surround mosques as thousands of people continue their protests against the regime. After a meeting of the Arctic Council in Greenland, environmentalists raise concerns about gas and oil drilling in this delicate region. And the NATO Secretary General responds to criticisms about the mission in Libya. Those stories and more, but first, this news.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for Free Speech Radio News. Debris, blown out shop windows, and blood. That was the scene today in northwest Pakistan after two suicide bomb attacks at a paramilitary training facility. The Taliban has taken responsibility for the blasts in the town of Shabkadar near Peshawar. At least 80 people are dead, most of them trainees. Dozens more were injured. A Taliban spokesperson told the Associated Press that the blast was in retaliation for the death of Osama bin Laden. He also said they plan to go after President Obama and any of his allies. As of Wednesday, the death toll from Japan's earthquake and tsunami stood at nearly 15,000, and about 10,000 more are still listed as missing. This week marked the two-month anniversary. Citizens are once again alarmed by news of a newly discovered hole in one of Fukushima nuclear plant's reactors. With the news of this meltdown, plant operator TEPCO now admits they have revised previous plans for plant stabilization, saying it will now take at least 9 instead of 6 months to remedy. And today, TEPCO announced plans to build giant tents over the reactors to help contain the leaking radiation. FSRN's Claudia Cragg has this update.
TEPCO's general manager, Junichi Matsumoto, has announced a large leak of several centimeters in Reactor 1. This means the reactor's fuel rods may have been completely exposed to the air for 2 months. Since the discovery, 10,400 tons of water have been pumped in as an emergency measure to cool it. But sealing newly discovered leaks in this way is perilous and difficult, according to nuclear experts, because workers need sustained access to areas of high radioactive exposure. Just Wednesday, TEPCO sealed a different leak of contaminated water they say may have been spilling into the ocean. As of now, the true extent of the leaks and seepage remains very unclear. Greenpeace Japan has released findings that seaweed, a Japanese diet staple, collected near the plant, has radiation levels 5 times the government's decreed safety limit. Environmentalists continue to raise concerns about accumulating radioactivity in marine ecosystems that provide Japan with a quarter of its seafood. Meanwhile, on Wednesday, Emperor Akihito and his wife paid an anniversary visit to Fukushima at precisely 2:46 p.m., the time of the quake, and came away from the site with 10 different locally grown fruits and vegetables. It's not known, however, whether the Japanese royals will actually consume the vegetables themselves. Claudia Cragg, FSRN.
As many as 6 protesters are dead in Yemen after government forces opened fire on mass demonstrations. Protesters have dubbed the day Friday of Decision. In the meantime, a Gulf Cooperation Council plan to usher President Ali Abdullah Saleh out of office took another hit today as Qatar pulled its support. Yemeni protesters have been opposed to the plan, saying it doesn't go far enough to ensure regime change. U.S. Middle East envoy George Mitchell is resigning from his post. Mitchell has primarily served as a mediator between Israel and Palestine during his 2 years of service, although little tangible progress has been made in striking a peace deal. As spring thaws and storms dump water into Middle America's rivers, floods have been wreaking havoc along the Mississippi, flooding cities like Memphis and the surrounding areas. Southern Louisiana isn't expecting high water for another week, but emergency steps are being planned to protect Baton Rouge, New Orleans, and the string of petrochemical plants and oil refineries between the two. FSRN's Zoe Sullivan reports.
The Mississippi River isn't expected to crest in New Orleans until late next week. Today, it flows relatively quietly along its levee banks, even as storms move through. But communities upriver have seen record flooding, despite efforts to divert some of the flow. During the first week of May, The Army Corps of Engineers blew three holes into Mississippi River levees to relieve pressure on the flood protection system downriver. Consequently, thousands of acres of farmland were flooded in Missouri. Yesterday, the river overtopped a natural levee in northern Louisiana, flooding 12,000 acres of farmland. Because of the expected high flow, on Monday, New Orleans officials opened the Bonnie Carey Spillway roughly 12 miles west of the city. That allows river water to flow into Lake Pontchartrain, and from there, the Gulf of Mexico. Currently, the Army Corps of Engineers is considering whether to open the Morganza Floodway, located north of Baton Rouge. If they do, roughly 25,000 people would be displaced from Cajun Country, including the population of Morgan City. The Morganza Floodway has been utilized on only one other occasion, in 1973. Zoe Sullivan, FSRN, New Orleans.
And that's headlines for Free Speech Radio News. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Danny Wood in San Francisco. In Syria today, thousands of people demonstrated in cities across the country. The weekly protests following Friday prayers have continued despite a growing crackdown by police and security forces, which have surrounded entire towns and cut off telecommunications, electricity, and water. In this video footage uploaded to YouTube, said to be from a protest in the town of Al-Ramla today, a group of young men chant and set light to a banner of President Bashar al-Assad. At least three people have been killed, two of them in Homs, where security forces opened fire in spite of a promise by President Assad that troops would not fire on protesters. In the city of Deraa, a focus of protests and a heavy government crackdown in recent days using tanks and live ammunition, Amar Kurabi, head of the Arab Organization for Human Rights, told Bloomberg News that people were barred from attending Friday prayers and that there were tanks outside every mosque. An activist in Al-Qadam near Damascus told the BBC what was happening at mosques in his neighborhood.
The fear has been planted in the hearts of these people. They're taking so strict and suppressive measures. Once they leave the mosque, anyone who shouts or who says at least freedom, they directly run towards him and start hitting him and directly take him to their cars. Today, I went to Al-Hasan Mosque in El Midan. They didn't allow me to enter.
Reuters, quoting Syria's information minister, said the president would start a round of national dialogue with the provinces in the coming days. The United Nations said that although it is unable to confirm the death toll, figures provided by NGOs documenting between 700 and 850 deaths and thousands of arrests appeared to be accurate. NATO has increased its airstrikes on what it says are military targets in Libya. But some critics say the alliance is going too far and that there's no end in sight to the conflict. Matt Laszlo talked to the NATO Secretary General, Anders Fogh Rasmussen, about the mission and has this story from Washington.
More than 2,000 bombs and missiles have been dropped on Libya since NATO launched Operation Unified Protector. Some of those missiles have killed civilians. Some have fallen on the compound of Muammar Gaddafi. One killed his son and three grandkids. What's the mission? Is NATO trying to kill the Libyan leader? We put the question to NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen.
My response is just to reiterate that we do not target individuals. We are targeting military facilities, including command and control centers.
Many observers don't believe that. Gaddafi hadn't been seen in about 2 weeks, and then a fresh video of him came out. Hours later, NATO dropped bombs on his compound, hitting an area for visiting VIPs. When pressed, Rasmussen said that NATO had received fresh evidence of offensive military action from the compound, and he denied that NATO was trying to assassinate Gaddafi.
I don't want to go into operational details, but I can assure you that our military commanders are very careful in identifying legitimate military targets.
So if NATO says it isn't trying to kill Gaddafi, and he isn't stepping down, then how will the mission play out? Johns Hopkins professor Robert Gutman says that's the quandary international forces have gotten themselves into.
I mean, the obvious goal, Obama said this, French president said it, the British prime minister said it, they want to get rid of Gaddafi. So I'm not a military person, but Gaddafi doesn't seem like the kind of person that's just going to say, oh, I'm leaving. So we have this, problem. We want to get rid of Gaddafi, but he's not leaving. So there's the stalemate right there.
The declared United Nations mission is to protect civilians from attacks by their leader. But Gutman says the mission is complicated.
NATO's protecting civilian population. The civilian population is made up of rebels who are trying to get rid of Gaddafi. So they're helping the other side, basically. And so there's got to be a conclusion. And if Gaddafi stays in power, it stays a stalemate. And then the UN mandate and NATO, mandate doesn't get resolved.
Critics say that means the mission is precarious at best. Millions of dollars have been thrown into the war, yet the UK and the US still don't recognize the rebels as a legitimate government. The rebels are trying to change that. Leaders were in London yesterday and at the White House today. They want more support, but it's slow in coming. Rasmussen says he wants to do all he can to help the revolutionaries, but he adds that the international community cannot come across as domineering, because youths across the Middle East are embracing democracy on their own.
I think it's important to understand that the driving force for the so-called Arab Spring has been a strong call, not least among the young generation, a strong call for freedom and democracy. And I don't think we should interfere with that. We can, if they so request, we can assist them in the transition to democracy.
With Gaddafi still in power for the foreseeable future, that transition becomes much harder because the rebels continue to trade ground with Gaddafi forces as they fight with a superior fighting force. Supplies are running low in parts of the country, and many Libyans are getting frustrated. The head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee, John Kerry of Massachusetts, says patience is needed.
There's a lot happening. There's a big opposition. Misrata was just lost to Gaddafi. The airfield was just lost to Gaddafi. There are increasing pressures. I just think, this takes time. Milosevic was in power for a year after the bombings in Serbia. I think that Gaddafi does not have a great hand to play here.
With the U.S. and NATO already involved in numerous wars, critics say there needs to be an exit strategy. As of yet, officials say there is none, and it's unclear how the stalemate will be resolved. Matt Laszlo, FSRN, Washington.
In Bahrain, the head of the military said yesterday that troops sent by Saudi Arabia to help crush the unrest will remain after emergency rule is lifted next month. As news of human rights abuses in Bahrain continues to mount, activists testified before a human rights commission in Washington, D.C. and urged the Obama administration to condemn the violence. Michael Lawson has more.
While not receiving as much attention, protests in Bahrain began on February 14th, the 10th anniversary of the adoption of the National Action Charter that restored constitutional rule to the kingdom. Since then, activists and human rights groups say hundreds of people are missing and some have been tortured by security forces. Congressmember James McGovern is co-chair of the Tom Lantos Human Rights Commission, named after the only Holocaust survivor to serve in Congress.
The United States and Bahrain have an important friendship that serves the needs and interests of both countries. Also, during the last decade, Bahrain has shown a willingness to address human rights issues in a constructive manner. It is important to recognize and appreciate those facts. However, there are times when one friend needs to tell another that something is wrong.
Bahrain is considered an ally to the United States. The U.S. Navy's Fifth Fleet is based in the country. According to the United Nations, Bahrain has the fastest-growing economy in the Arab world. The government of Bahrain, in a statement provided to the commission, blames much of the uprising on interference from Iran. Joe Stork of Human Rights Watch reported masked men coming to homes in the middle of the night and people being pulled from cars at checkpoints. He says the ability of the government to suppress protests and erase evidence has hampered coverage.
So this is not like Libya, where you have an armed insurgency. This is not Syria, where thousands of people are on the streets every week, if not every day. This is a place where the government very quickly and very comprehensively suppressed all manner of protest.
Stork wants the Obama administration to take the lead in calling for a UN Human Rights Council session. While Stork believes the administration is working with Bahrain behind the scenes, including a call from the White House to its king 10 days ago, he says public explicit statements condemning government abuses are necessary to elicit change.
As long as the U.S. speaks forcefully regarding violations in Iran, Syria, and Libya, as it should, but is publicly silent when it comes to Bahrain. It undermines its efforts and credibility to promote human rights in all countries, whether allies and adversaries.
The Bahrain Center for Human Rights is an NGO that's been targeted by the government. Its current president has been beaten and detained. And its former president, opposition leader Abdul Hadi Al-Hawaja, was beaten unconscious and arrested. He currently faces trial with 13 others. His daughter, Mariam Al-Hawaja, is head of foreign relations for the center.
He had four fractures in his face, three in his cheek and one in his jaw. And he looked very bad. The whole left side of his face was swollen. And this was due to the beatings he had received from the security forces. He also explicitly told my family that he was being tortured in detention.
Mariam says in addition to severe human rights abuses, there is a daily campaign by the government to invoke fear. According to information obtained by the center, 30 people have been killed, about 950 remain in detention, and 25% of detainees are under the age of 18. Physicians for Human Rights has been tracking reports of scores of doctors and medical personnel who have been detained, as well as protesters who have been subject to detainment and harassment at the hospital. Richard Solom, Deputy Director of Physicians for Human Rights, says because medical personnel are the first to see injuries and causes, they have become targets for the Bahraini government. Solom says his group has heard corroborated testimony that patients have been tortured on the sixth floor of the hospital and recorded being forced to say they are agents of the Iranian government.
This is a really insidious campaign of not only human rights violations, but also linking it to Iran to spread and sow fear.
Secretary of State Hillary Clinton received a letter Friday from human rights groups strongly urging the United States to convene a special session on Bahrain at the United Nations Human Rights Council. Officials from the State Department declined to testify at Friday's hearing. The AFL-CIO has petitioned the Obama administration to warn Bahrain that its crackdown on anti-government protests has put a 2006 trade pact at risk. Michael Lawson, FSRN, Washington.
First, they ignore you. Then they laugh at you. Then they fight you. Then you win.
I heard him say the revolution won't be televised. Al Jazeera proved him wrong. Twitter has him paralyzed. 80 million strong and ain't no longer gonna be terrorized, organized.
When a pro-democracy movement took to the streets of the Arab world in December and January, many of its youth participants brought their change-inspiring music with them.
Yalla. Al-hip-hop al-masri. Al-ajnabi.
Nigerian musician Fela Kuti said that music is the weapon of the future, and the critical lyrics and homegrown beats of Arab hip-hop played their own role in the so-called Arab Spring uprisings. FSRN plans to produce a documentary on the connection between hip-hop and the Arab uprisings, but we need your help. Visit fsrn.org to find out how you can support this project, Arab Hip-Hop, a soundtrack to the Arab Spring. In Greenland yesterday, the Arctic Council, that includes the US, Russia, and Canada, signed its first legally binding agreement, which establishes policies for search and rescue operations. Members also discussed better ways of preventing and dealing with oil spills in that region. Observers say future agreements could include contentious issues like oil and gas exploration that are strongly opposed by environmental groups. For many years, Greenpeace has tried to protect the fragile Arctic environment where there's growing evidence of melting sea ice and retreating coastline. For more, we go to John Hosever, Greenpeace Oceans Campaign Director. Welcome to Free Speech Radio News.
Thanks, it's a pleasure.
The US is one of the Arctic Council members, which include the eight countries bordering the area and indigenous leaders. But this is the first time a US Secretary of State has attended this annual meeting. Do you see US interests growing in the region, and what are those interests?
It does seem that US interests are growing. The Arctic is one of the key pieces of President Obama's new national ocean policy, which is in draft. It seems like that what's really driving this is the U.S. trying to make sure that they get their piece of the oil and gas pie. And that's really unfortunate. You know, it seems like we're in a situation where all these countries are looking to take advantage of the melting sea ice and get access to oil and gas resources. And it's creating very considerable tensions between many of the Arctic nations.
In line with that, just before this meeting, WikiLeaks leaked a secret U.S. diplomatic cable that suggests the U.S., Russia, and Canada are all now looking to stake their claims and exploit Arctic resources. Have you seen that cable, and were you surprised by that revelation? Sounds like you're probably not.
It confirms what we've known and suspected all along, and it's really disappointing, but not surprising. The U.S. has been moving down that road for many years, and many of the Arctic countries have been really saber-rattling for quite a while now, you know, increasing military exercises in the Arctic, which on the face of it seems absurd given how remote and, you know, really empty many of the areas are.
Arctic members yesterday signed the first legally binding agreement, and this one including on search and rescue operations, but they also discussed preventing and responding to oil spills, indicating that oil exploration is a priority for those council members. And days before this meeting, Greenland's government granted licenses to Cairn Energy to drill 4 offshore wells in the Arctic region. How much oil drilling is actually taking place in the Arctic now?
It's really just starting. There isn't any drilling in the U.S. Arctic Ocean, and there's a bid off of Greenland that's just begun, and I think a little bit more in Norway. Russia is really looking to get involved quickly. The U.S., you know, they're considering plans to allow Shell and BP to drill in the Arctic Ocean as early as next year.
For many years now, Greenpeace, your organization, has been pushing for measures to defend the region from oil drilling, from destructive fishing, and increased commercial shipping. Did this meeting yesterday make any progress on any of those fronts?
I'd say it was a step backward. I mean, the agreements that came out of this are really not going to have any conservation benefit, at least not in any meaningful sense. And it, more than anything, signaled the desire of these countries to continue to move forward with their plans to drill in the Arctic Ocean.
So what sorts of controls and safeguards exist on drilling in the Arctic now, and what would you like to see in place?
Unfortunately, it's very minimal at the moment. Within territorial waters, each country has their own permitting processes. And as we've seen in recent years, unfortunately, with the Deepwater Horizon spill, those are clearly insufficient. On the high seas, really all that's been preventing drilling in the past has been that it's been covered by sea ice. And now that that ice is melting, there isn't any agreement in place that would prevent another disaster.
You mentioned that warming and a climate report that was issued by a working group of this council found that in the last 6 years it's been the warmest period ever recorded in the Arctic. Snow cover and sea ice are decreasing, and glaciers and ice caps are melting faster this decade than the previous one. The report also found that the Arctic Ocean could be mostly ice-free in late summer within the next 30 to 40 years. Is there a connection between climate change in the Arctic and oil drilling and consumption?
Absolutely, and that's a conservative estimate. Other scientists have predicted that the Arctic Ocean could be ice-free as early as 2020, so just a few years out. So, you know, it's a bit of an intelligence test for humanity, really, when, on one hand, burning fossil fuels and our reliance on oil and coal has led to the global warming, which is melting the sea ice. Now that very outcome is making it possible for us to tap into even more oil and fossil fuels and further exacerbate the problem. You know, this is a key moment for us to realize that that's just not in any of our interests.
How would you like to see this Arctic Council respond to the concerns you have about climate change?
Really, it is on the Arctic Council and these nations to make a decision that it's not in any of our interests to allow drilling. And in fact, what we need is a treaty similar to what we have in the Antarctic, where the international community sets aside the Arctic as an area for peace and science. Otherwise, I think in addition to the fossil fuel problem and the risk of oil spills, we're going to see increased military tension between countries seeking to grab their peace.
John Hosever, head of the Greenpeace Oceans team, speaking to us from a busy Phoenix airport. Have a good trip and thanks very much for your time.
Thank you. Take care.
India's Election Commission today declared the results of provincial elections in four Indian states. Among the regions that went to the polls were the states of Kerala and West Bengal, where left-wing parties have been in power. But today's results have reversed the power equation by huge margins, and many in India are calling it a watershed moment. Bismila Gilani has the story.
At Kolkata's Lenin Park, celebrations began even before the first results were announced. Thousands of people took to the streets, cheering, dancing, and hugging each other. The exit polls had already predicted a landslide win for the moderate regional party, the Trinamool Congress. Arijit is one of the party's supporters.
This is not a wind of change, it's a storm, and storms blow down even the strongest of structures, and then begins an era of reconstruction, which we will see now in West Bengal.
The Trinamool Congress won 228 of 294 seats, reducing the leftist alliance to just 61 seats. The left front has accepted the defeat. Sitaram Yechury is a senior leader with the Marxist Communist Party of India, or CPM.
After a record 34 years in office in West Bengal, having won 7 consecutive elections to the state assembly, the left front in these elections has been defeated. The people have opted for a change. We accept the verdict of the people.
In 2009, the left front suffered heavy losses in national elections and civic polls as well. Some say the left's confrontation with farmers over the issue of land acquisition for industries is the main reason for its decreasing popularity. Senior journalist Dipankar Gupta explains other factors that also contributed.
There's been a lot of discretion. There have been several corruption stories floating around. There have been several issues connected with Muslims. There have been issues of land issues in Nandigram, Singur. There have been issues about rampant violence by the CPM. Now, all of these negative elements have fundamentally fueled the movement away from the left.
The Communist Alliance also lost the majority in the southern state of Kerala, where the Congress Party-led alliance will now form the government. The northeastern state of Tripura is now the only state where the left still remains in power. Senior communist leaders say the occasion calls for a deep introspection and reorientation of the movement. Bismillah Gilani, Free Speech Radio News, New Delhi.
That's the program for today and this week. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Headlines editor was Jess Burns. Our Washington, D.C. editor was Matt Laszlo. Our technical production team at KPFA in Berkeley is Rose Katapchi and Jane Chang. FSRN welcomes your questions, comments, and news tips. Write to us, comments@fsrn.org. For more news stories, specials, and our documentaries, visit our website, fsrn.org, and follow us on Twitter at twitter.com/fsrn. Thanks for listening. In San Francisco, I'm Danny Wood.